A big chunk of Americans, somewhat north of 40%, get most of their news online. Now, break that chunk into pieces, and we find about 1 in 5 Americans getting their news primarily from social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, et al. The same research that pulled up the numbers also shows that people who rely heavily upon social media for their information, primarily, are less engaged and less informed. That's a problem for society at large, one detailed at length in a new book. Sinan Iral gives history, context, and a view to a possible future in The Hype Machine, how social media disrupts our elections, our economy, and our health, and how we must adapt. Sinan Iral has been all over the tech and social media world as scientist, entrepreneur, and investor. He works at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, as head of the Social Analytics Lab, director of the Initiative on the Digital Economy, and a professor of management, marketing, IT, and data science. Sinan Iral, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, just to lay out one major credential, you did your doctoral studies on digital social networks when?
I started studying this in the year 2000, so 4 years before Facebook was founded, and I've been studying it for 20 years.
Wow. So as you watched social media grow and helped it do so, did you think it would end up about where it is now?
Well, it's funny. I think I realized early on that it was going to have dramatic effects on our society, much more so than other people did at the time, I think. But there's no way that anyone, and certainly I didn't, could have foreseen the magnitude of the impact and the dramatic, both positive and negative effects that it's had on our society, from our economies to our democracies to our public health.
Well, to the subtitle of the book, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt, I mean, social media was supposed to disrupt, wasn't it?
Well, sort of. I mean, if you think about the last two decades, it was a decade of techno-utopianism around social media. It was supposed to connect the world in meaningful ways, give us real human connection, access to information, economic opportunity, life-saving health information, and so on. It was supposed to foster free speech and democracy. And then that was followed by a decade of techno-dystopianism, where social media essentially became a pariah. Sacha Baron Cohen called it the greatest propaganda machine in history. We've seen this very hot documentary now on Netflix called The Social Dilemma, which is all about the problems that social media can cause in our society, from polarization to effects on our elections and so on. And really, this book attempts to transcend the techno-utopianism on one hand and the techno-dystopianism on the other hand. And it really takes off where the social media, where the Social Dilemma movie leaves off, in asking, what can we do? If we were actually going to practically roll up our sleeves and do something about the social media morass that we find ourselves in, what would we do and how could we do it to achieve the promise and avoid the peril?
Mm-hmm. Promise and peril is a constant dichotomy in the book, so you're going to be hearing that a lot. I'll assure the listeners of that. You do preface the book with the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, social media use was certainly up, sure, but what else did you see?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Social media in the COVID-19 pandemic, the usage up, but what else did you observe?
Right, so in the COVID pandemic, we experienced what I call a COVID 180. Mm-hmm. So at the end of 2019 is when social media was a pariah, and then we were forced to all shelter in our homes and get online, and we found that it was a tremendous source for human connection, for information, for staying connected with work or collaborators and so on. And the social media companies all broke records during the pandemic. And Mark Zuckerberg was quoted as saying, "We're just trying to keep the lights on over here. There was so much demand." But we also saw a ton of misinformation flying around about the COVID pandemic specifically. And a lot of these things have to do with false cures that can actually be harmful or kill you, but not that many people were directly affected by those. The thing that worries me the most about the spread of misinformation around COVID specifically is vaccine confidence. So we're running a big survey, the largest in the world, in collaboration with Facebook and the WHO right now at MIT, trying to understand people's beliefs, perceptions, and their espoused behaviors around COVID. And one of the trackers is about vaccine hesitancy around will you take the vaccine or not. And misinformation about the vaccine could go a long way for reducing the number of people that are willing to take the vaccine, which is going to make it much more difficult for us to control this pandemic.
So in terms of the general feelings of promise and peril of social media for you, does that change daily, weekly, hourly?
Well, when I look back over the last 20 years of social media, I see so many examples of the deleterious effects, obviously. There's, you know, the effects, the rise of measles in 2019, the fake news spreading during the COVID pandemic, the real economic harms of false tweets. As I described, there's a story in the book about a tweet that was tweeted by the Associated Press. It turned out to be Syrian hackers that were claiming that Barack Obama had been killed or injured in an explosion in the White House, wiped out $140 billion in equity value in the stock market in a matter of minutes. And that's just one tweet. We see trillions of tweets a day, so it can have a dramatic economic impact. But on the other hand, you know, the promise really has shown itself in a number of situations. When Nepal experienced its greatest earthquake in 100 years, Europe donated $3 million, the U.S. $10 million. Facebook spun up a Donate Now button and raised $15.5 million from 770,000 people in 175 countries, more than the U.S. and Europe combined. It creates $370 billion in consumer surplus every year in the United States alone. The examples of the promise are also evident. Mm-hmm. The problem I see now is we're kind of asleep at the switch.
Okay, hold it there. We'll come back to asleep at the switch. So, Sinan, you were just giving some examples of both promise and peril, and to use the other term, techno-utopianism and techno-dystopianism, sort of present at once, but you were starting to say we're asleep at the switch?
Yeah, so I think that we're just now waking up to how powerful this technology is in our society from all of the different examples that we've been through. And so I wanted to do two things in this book. First, to give people an understanding of how it works in the hood, under the hood, from basically the neuroscience foundations of what happens inside our brains as we use social media, all the way through to the policy questions that are front and center right now. There are a number of important policy questions. The last chapter in the book is about what do we do and how do we adapt? And questions like, should we break up Facebook? Will that solve the problems? Should there be federal privacy legislation to protect our data, our individual data in the United States? What do we do about the line between free speech and hate speech? How do we protect our elections from social media manipulation from foreign actors? All of these topics, you know, we've been looking at MIT for many years, and so I have a detailed set of suggestions for how we get out of this mess.
Well, and before we even consider that, I did find myself thinking about halfway through the book or wondering if social media is something like the atomic bomb of our time, something that we simply hope we can keep under control.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm a firm believer that technology, the product of technology, is in how we use it, how we regulate it, how we design it. So the four levers that I describe in terms of how we do this in the book are called money, code, norms, and laws. And money is the business models and the incentives they create in the social media economy. Code is the design of the platforms and the algorithms underlying the news feed, as well as the friend suggestion algorithms, which shape the structure of the network and the flow of information over it. Norms is how we use it. It talks about cyberbullying, but also how we appropriate and use the technology and the norms that we create around it. And obviously, the laws are in the regulation of antitrust, of privacy, and so on. It is, in a sense, like any other technology, like the atomic bomb or other things, a function of how we design and use it. It's not path dependent as being either good or evil on its own.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we talk about promise and peril of social media, which are, you know, the constant phrase used throughout the book. Now, the peril is one of the first examples. How did Russia use social media to take over Crimea?
Oh, so this is the story that opens the book. And I opened the book with this story because I present new evidence on this in the book that we haven't seen before. So the interesting thing about what happened in Crimea, it was one of the first examples of a geopolitical actor using social media in this way. The annexation of Crimea was the first time since World War II that European borders were redrawn by force. And there was a very well-planned kind of military operation. But in addition, there was an incredibly sophisticated information operation. And what they did was they created fake news and spread it, but then they also suppressed the opinions of, pro-Ukrainian opinions on media and social media in the region at the time as well. So they trained social media robots to essentially immediately flag Ukrainian voices as abuse or hate speech or porn so that it would be taken down. And then they created false narratives. For instance, there was a false narrative about a doctor who was claiming that he was being essentially abused by Ukrainian forces and that this was anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish. And some of the false narratives were parroted almost verbatim by Sergei Lavrov, who is the foreign minister of Russia at the UN. And the way I found this out was we did a big study on fake news that was on the cover of Science magazine, where we studied all the true and false verified stories that ever spread on Twitter from 2006 to 2017. In that, there's a subset of that information that is what we call mixed news, which is partially true, partially false. Mm-hmm. And when I dug into the data, the biggest spike in mixed news, which was four times greater than any other spike in mixed news in the 10 years of data that we had on Twitter, happened during the annexation of Crimea, and it decreased just as quickly as it rose. As the annexation was happening, it went up, and then it came right back down again. And when I looked into the actual news stories that were spreading, there was a very clear link among the top news stories with exactly what the Russian foreign minister was saying.
Interesting. So, and I noticed in the past too that it seems like the Russians are careful, and they've done this with the American market on vaccines to make sure that they hit both sides just a little bit, not to make it look too suspicious or something.
Well, I think that one of the primary goals is to just to seed confusion, dissent, disorder, conflict. So it's not necessarily just to advocate for one position or the other. They want to create conflict. A great example of this is that on a single street corner in Houston, Texas, they created two protests at the same time on opposite sides of the street opposing each other so that they could create conflict between these two sides. It was about the opening of a historic Islamic center in downtown Houston, and they organized a protest in support of the opening of this center and against the opening of this center directly across from each other at the same time. That's a perfect example of how they try to seed conflict into society.
But it's not like they come on and say, "Hi, this is Russia calling. Would you please go start a protest?" It's like, "Hi, this is Bobby from this neighborhood. You know, I'm going to go out and do this, and I think you should join me."
Exactly. So they impersonate real Americans, and then they recruit other real Americans to do the same. There are a number of examples and just wild stories in the book about how they really duped real citizens to join and to believe that they were legitimate organizations. I think it's pretty easy to fall for this because they create websites that look real. They call people with where the caller has an American accent, and they describe the organization. They try to recruit into the protest or the movement, and it works a lot of the time.
Well, so where I get to with some of this stuff, though, particularly with things that purport to be from quote-unquote news sources, whether we just suspend a disbelief or something when we're on social media. We seem to repeat or share things without checking first, and so we go with the emotional trigger and then maybe later go, oh, maybe I should have looked that up first.
I mean, you know, so the second chapter in the book is called The End of Reality, which is all about what happens when we lose track of our ability to tell truth from falsity in society. And it's not a pretty picture. However, I think that there are a number of very easy things we can do as citizens to address this, and you're getting at them already. So one of the things that I see most when I see fake news come across my social media is it's usually preceded by the preamble, I don't know if this is true, but it's really interesting if it is. And then we share it, right? We got to stop doing that because it's designed to be interesting if it's true, but it's not. The 80-20 rule applies to most of fake news in the sense that it can be debunked with just a few short clicks and a Google search just to see whether this is a known false narrative or not. And you're right. So our research that we published in Science Magazine back in 2018 showed that false news traveled farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than the truth in every category of information. And the reason for that is because it is surprising, anger-inducing, disgusting, salacious. So it gets our blood boiling. So if we feel sort of emotionally charged by something we're reading, we should take a beat, step back and say, is this real? You know, just think critically about it. Experimental research shows that when consumers are nudged to think critically, to be reflective, it reduces their belief in fake news and their sharing of fake news.
Sinan Aral is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor at MIT and also an entrepreneur and investor in social media with a very long history in it. He's written a very comprehensive book called The Hype Machine, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. You are more than welcome to put in your 2 cents worth on this conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. A couple of emails, a statement from Napoleon and a question from Krista. Napoleon says, as I like to remind white people, one man's utopia is another man's dystopia. People who use the term as an end goal are borderline fascists, but like true fascism, it's got a lot of delusion involved to make the argument functional. Thank you for that, Napoleon. Krista, no town given, says, I was wondering if your guest is familiar with Ian McGilchrist's book and work called The Master and His Emissary, which would be interesting to hear his take on the connection between our brain development and the use of social media, perhaps the unbalanced connection that we are seeing manifested, says Krista. Your thoughts on that?
Well, on the first point, I tend to agree with that. I'm not a fan of either the utopianism or the dystopianism. I think that different groups have different situations in society, and there is no one-size-fits-all. But I also think that regarding technology as either a savior or a devil is the wrong approach, that we have to approach this practically and try to solve some of these problems. I'm not familiar with The Master and His Emissary, but I've written it down. So I definitely want to take a look at that and see what it's all about.
All right. Thank you again, Napoleon and Krista, for your emails. And then we have a phone call here from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I was introduced to Facebook on the Internet by Facebook approaching me through emails saying that certain people who I knew were trying to contact me, and I knew that they were not. And that got my attention right up front with that organization, and I have had nothing to do with them ever since I saw that kind of communication process being initiated by them, not by me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that's been my experience with so-called social media, which I consider to be an oxymoron. And I am, as an electrical engineer, familiar to some degree with something called the entropy of information. And what it basically, the basic rule is that when you're in an information system, not an intelligence system, but an information system, of which we're surrounded now very tightly, the system tends to self-destruct, like we tend over a period of time to not be alive anymore. And what I would like to hear from you, more the contents of what's happening to us, is the basic rules of information and intelligence that we're breaking left and right in the systems that we've surrounded ourselves by. So I'm listening.
All right. Thank you, Carter. Appreciate that.
Carter, great question. I really appreciate that question. I'm a huge fan of Claude Shannon, who is the, you know, grandfather now of information theory and mathematical theories of entropy. And in fact, in the study that I mentioned earlier, we actually use the concept of entropy to measure the novelty of the information. So actually, entropy and information theory is a big part of the research program that I've conducted over the last 20 years. Let me take your first question and then your second question. So that reaching out to you by email is a part of a process that social media companies use called growth hacking, which is essentially a set of techniques used to expand the user base of the platforms to get new users. And what they've done there is that they have taken, they've asked your friends who have gotten onto Facebook whether they can have access to their email lists so that they know who they're friends with and they can make suggestions about who they should connect to and so on. And then they've taken those email addresses, and it depends on when you got this email because it would have their policies have changed over the years. But in the early years, they might have sent you an email without the knowledge of your friend to say, oh, you know, your friend would love to see you on Facebook, and that they would have sent that email to everyone of your friends, of the friends of your friend who is in their email box. And that's a part of the process of growth hacking. In terms of entropy, you know, I think that an important part of this information ecosystem is to really kind of study the way that the ebb and flow of information over the human social network and over the population. It is a critical part of, for instance, understanding why fake news travels so much farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than the truth. I'll get to that in a minute. And things like political polarization, the degree to which pockets of information exist in certain clusters in the network, but not in others. So in terms of the spread of false news, what we found was when we looked at the novelty of information. So if I look at false tweets coming into your Twitter account compared to the 60 days of what you'd seen beforehand, what we found by using information theory like mutual knowledge as an example of an information theory concept, we measured that false news was indeed much more novel than the truth. And when you study the cognitive science literature, you find that our attention is drawn to novelty. Human attention is drawn to novelty. And the sociology literature teaches us that we gain in status when we share novel information because it looks like we're in the know or that we have access to inside information. And in this way, information theory can help us understand the spread of fake news and why it's so much faster. In terms of the clustering and polarization, if you have algorithms that give people different kinds of information, you'll have factions that have very divergent perceptions of reality. That reduces the common ground that those factions have for collaborating, communicating, or finding a negotiable settlement. That's part of what we see in affective political polarization in the United States today.
So, all right, we have to get to a break here in just a moment, but you know, you've just given the basis for journalism, too, novelty. I mean, the whole old joke about journalism is we don't cover Dog Bites Man, but Man Bites Dog is novel, and that's the stuff we'll cover. So it all sort of cuts back to the original circle of the original media. So, Sanan, what's going on in our brains? What pulls us in the first place? What reward does it give us in the depths of our neurons?
You know, this is one of the most fascinating chapters in the book for me to research, and the things I learned here were really quite eye-opening. So it turns out that human beings have one of the largest brains to body weight ratios of any species on the planet, and we have one of the largest neocortex ratios of any species on the planet. That's the ratio of the neocortex of our brain to the rest of our brain, and there are many hypotheses for why this is the case, but one of the leading hypotheses is called the social brain hypothesis, which is that we evolved over millions of years to process social signals so that we could understand our complex sociality, and that, you know, I mean, human beings are the most sophisticated social species on the planet. We have organizations of hundreds of millions of people. We collaborate at scale over digital technology around the world every day. And so part of the reason, one of the main reasons we evolved is to process these social signals. And then we invented a technology that scaled these social signals into the trillions per day coming from millions of people in real time. Likes, comments, shares, what your cousin ate for lunch yesterday on Instagram are really just social signals about what the people in your networks are doing, thinking, liking, sharing, etc. So the meteoric rise of social media is in some sense not surprising, because it's like tossing a lit match into a pool of gasoline when our brains have evolved to process these signals. And social media was designed for our brains. So a good example of that is the dopamine reward system, which I describe in the book. We get a dopamine hit every time we get a like or a share or a comment on our media on social media. And in fact, Sean Parker told Mike Allen in 2017 in an interview, yeah, we designed Facebook to be that way, to give you that little dopamine hit every time you get a like or a share or a comment on your content that you post, to keep you coming back for more and to hook you into using it. And so this chapter goes into all of the details of the fMRI and neuroscience, cognitive science, scientific evidence about what happens in our brain as we use social media. And it, for instance, I have a 7-year-old son. So as a father, I think to myself about what the impact of this technology might be on our kids. There's an interesting study done at UCLA where they randomly assigned more or less likes to pictures depicting risky behaviors like taking drugs and alcohol or neutral behaviors. And what they found was that when an image of risky behavior gets more likes on Instagram, it turns off or turns down the response inhibition network in our kids' brains, making them less cautious Wow. about engaging in those behaviors. Those kind, and that's one of maybe 40 different studies that are in that chapter, and so it was very eye-opening for me.
Well, so that's on kids. I mean, do the rest of us kind of throw caution to the winds? I mean,
Yes,
you just answered it.
Yes, the answer is yes. So that study was replicated in adults as well, and most of this works in the same way in adult brains as it does in kids' brains, although there are some differences.
We have a phone call here from Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sanan Aral, the author of The Hype Machine.
Thank you. To me, it's very obvious why lies spread so much faster than facts. It's because they're more exciting, and people go for excitement. And if you've ever seen the movie Idiocracy, I think that's exactly where we're heading. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Well, you know, when she talks about excitement, you know, I do kind of wonder if this is like the way we watch horror movies and take roller coaster rides.
Well, I mean, I think Anne is absolutely correct. And if she was still on the phone, I'd ask her if we could recruit her at MIT, because she basically predicted the result of our 10-year study. And that's why I called the book The Hype Machine. It's designed in its business models and its algorithms to hype us up And the reason it's designed to do that is because its business model runs on our engagement with the content. Its business model is about selling our attention as a precursor to persuasion, the ability for organizations, businesses, governments to advertise to us to try and change our shopping, dating, voting, exercise behaviors. And the way that they keep us engaged is to hype us up. And that is why fake news travels farther, faster, deeper. It's more exciting, it's more salacious, disgusting, anger-inducing, and novel.
Hmm. So give us a time map now, if you would, Sanan. How closely does political polarization, we'll start with the United States, correlate with the rise of social media?
Well, you know, the rise of political polarization in the United States is a very complicated subject, mm-hmm. in the sense that ideological polarization hasn't changed much in the last 50 years. What has changed dramatically is the alignment of those polarized views into along party lines. And that kind of separation of the left and the right has happened dramatically, and affective polarization has risen dramatically. Affective polarization is essentially the hatred of one party to the other has risen dramatically, and it corresponds uncannily to the rise of Facebook. So it really does start in the early 2000s and increase over time. But as I detail in the book, that doesn't necessarily mean that Facebook is responsible entirely or even partly responsible for the political polarization. There are a number of other factors, obviously, at play. What I do in the book is I go through all of the experimental and large-scale scientific evidence for filter bubbles, echo chambers, and their role in ripping us apart in society today.
I think I know what the echo chambers are. What's the filter bubble?
The filter bubble is very similar to the echo chamber. The echo chamber is that you're in a community or a group online that all has the same views, and you're just kind of ricocheting the same views and ideas around your tight-knit community. The filter bubble is that the algorithms are giving you more and more of what you like and are shutting out diverse and opposing views from your from what you read and see.
So nothing to challenge your way of thinking, and it's like, yeah, I'm really right, and my friends are right, too, and we're all right about this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's amazing how completely unrelated the information that someone on the left might be to might get than someone on the right on, say, Facebook. There have been experiments done, which I describe at length in the book, where their news feeds were injected with more liberal, if they're conservative, mm-hmm. More liberal views, and if they're liberal, more conservative views, and that this really did have an effect on reducing affective polarization, hatred of one party to another. Quite dramatic results, actually, by Roe Levy at Yale, who did a very big study on Facebook about this.
So to come back to politics, in 2016, there was a report on, was it on Facebook, about Hillary Clinton in a cage,
right,
in a pickup truck in Florida?
That's right, yeah. So one of the chapters opens with that story. And I do try in this book to really to start from the narrative arc of the stories of real life that are happening, and then to really connect that to the actual detailed large observation studies and science about why those events that we see in real life are happening. And this event that you're talking about is, there was a protest that was organized that had Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in a cage in a jail cell in the back of a pickup truck at a Florida Goes Trump rally, and this rally was created. It was American actors put on Hillary and Bill Clinton masks, built a jail cell, loaded it up onto the back of a pickup truck, drove it to a cheesecake factory, met with many other people who were part of this protest, created videos of the rally, not protest, but rally, that was pro-Trump rally, and then posted that to YouTube and then shared it on on Twitter and Facebook and social media, and this entire event and all of the amplification of the videos and material that were created by this event was created by Russia by prompting American citizens to create a rally by contacting them over social media and encouraging them to participate in a rally that no Russians showed up to, but that existed only because of Russian manipulation.
Okay, so here is where we take a deep breath and ask if we can know if events in the physical world are initiated outside of the United States.
I think we can. So the problem is that we don't have access to the data that it would require to do that. And that's part of the reason why we know so little about the threat to our election in the next few weeks coming up. There needs to be a lot more transparency on the part of these organizations, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. And there are some initiatives that are trying to build industry academic partnerships for us to understand. There also needs to be more auditing and reporting of election integrity and manipulation. And there needs to be a tremendously more transparency if we're going to know the answer. But the short answer is we do know how to figure out the degree to which those real-world events were caused by manipulative social media messages. We just don't have the data to figure it out yet.
I have taken the Clemson University quiz on identifying which are bogus, made-up accounts on social media and which are not. Does MIT offer something like that? I got a 6 out of 10 or 6 out of 8, actually.
6 out of 10. Okay. That's good. We don't have a quiz like that, but we think that those types of things are important. In the book, I talk a lot about the media literacy programs that are cropping up to try and teach adults and kids how to spot fake news and when to how to figure out when things are phony. For kids, they've built games that will help them learn how to do that, and for adults, there are short courses and things like that. I think we need a lot more of that.
Let's take a final phone call here before we're done from Patricia in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I am just calling to praise Facebook's aid in the recent kidnapping of my friends in Arcata from Freshwater. They were and the person who kidnapped them, three people were kidnapped. My friend and her adult son were left in the middle of Orleans in the middle of at night. And the next day, when they finally went and found, they were able to find a human mm-hmm. in Orleans, the woman recognized him from my Facebook announcement and knew instantly to call the sheriff and what the story was. And then she texted me, on Messenger and told me, "You don't know me, but your friends are safe."
Oh.
And it was very exciting, and I'm just saying,
okay.
It does come in handy.
All right, so some good uses for it. Thank you for that, Patricia. And I want to get a response from Sanan before we have to go.
Yeah. No, I thank you so much, Patricia, for that example. This is one of countless examples of the real impact, that positive impact that Facebook has on people's lives. I detail examples like this, like increases in organ donation. That Nepal earthquake that we talked about earlier, they have a feature called Safety Check, which automatically notifies friends of people in an earthquake region when they're safe, just like that message that you got. And wow, during that earthquake, it almost created the greatest sigh of relief in human history, because millions of people were messaged just like you about the safety of their friends. There is promise here. There is also peril, and this book tries to help us figure out how to achieve the one without the other.
Promise and peril all the way through the book, The Hype Machine, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. It's by Sanan Aral at MIT. Sanan, thank you so much.
Appreciate you having me.
Take care.